Welcome to FilmWax Radio, the independent film talk show. Today, my guest is Brandon Harris. He was one of my first guests and has been so generous coming back and providing such great verbal intercourse. Brandon Harris is one of the most tirelessly prolific individuals when it comes to his contributions covering the independent film world. Perhaps most noted for his contributions to Filmmaker magazine. He's a regular contributor. He also writes for a myriad other periodicals, including a recent The New Inquiry, where he writes about Richard Pryor. He has a piece that's been getting a lot of buzz in a Brooklyn Rail. He's a filmmaker. He has a film called Red Legs, which I'm proud to say that screened as part of the Film Wax film series. And he produces several films. He's currently producing a number of projects. And if that weren't enough, Brandon has recently begun curating a new film series, the Hammer to Nail film series, related to, of course, the blog Hammer to Nail, a bi-weekly series which will take place at the Bushwick venue called Brooklyn Fireproof. I welcome Brandon back to FilmWax Radio now for, I believe, his third visit.
Hi, this is Brandon Harris.
Good. FilmWax you could Radio. Do so bad about asking people to do that. The last one I remember to ask to like do one of those kind of shout out IDs.
Yeah.
Was Barry Levinson.
Oh really?
And he did. He was great.
That's awesome.
Yeah. Instead of saying director of The Bay, though, could you say of Diner?
Yeah. Know?
Or Wag the Dog.
This is nothing. This is nothing. The plane crashed. This is nothing. Under control. I love that movie. Wag the Dog.
Mm-hmm.
It's
mm-hmm.
great.
Mm-hmm.
Great movie. Lenny,
like
this
thing.
Is nothing. You've never dealt with a star. He won't get up in the morning to come to your set.
The last thing I remember that De Niro did that was interesting, probably.
I like Silver Linings Playbook.
Oh.
I think that's a good movie.
I don't know. The scene, you know, that he cries, though, it's almost as though they cut to it. He was already kind of, like he plucked the nose hair or something.
Right. But that's not the only scene he's good in. He's like, I think that's like a broadly well-performed and funny.
And nuanced.
Nuanced movie.
Well, I guess I have to see it again. And
Did you hear that Bradley Cooper and David O. Russell are going to go talk to Joe Biden about mental health issues?
They're now ambassadors?
They're ambassadors, yeah.
Oh, well, good for them.
I'm hoping that David O. Russell just suggests that he legalize marijuana since David's such a fan of the dope.
I didn't know that.
Yeah, that's like, what they have to have French lunches where they always have hot food. Instead of stopping every 6 hours for lunch, they actually always have hot food on the sets of his film. Because if they don't, he'll go to his trailer during lunch and smoke a fatty. And then the second half of the day, he's moving a little slow.
Yeah. Things slow down, regardless of...
slow down a little bit. So anyway, yeah, no, I like that movie, though. I think that's good. I think De Niro's been, like, decent in a few things that people don't really acknowledge.
What one has to do is to pretend to have never seen him in something before, especially anything prior to 1981 or 2.
I mean...
And then think, okay, this is just some other actor. And do I like the performance? Because the bar is so high because of this first decade of filmmaking.
But, I mean, I also consider, like, I think there was, like, a method phase he went through in the mid-70s that doesn't actually have a lot to do with his early 70s and, like, late 60s performances. Mm-hmm. Have you seen, like, Hi Mom, for instance, by Brian De Palma?
That was Brian De Palma's first...
Second film.
Second film out of Columbia or something?
Yeah. Okay. And it is... awesome. But, I mean, it has the type of comedic performance that De Niro, certainly by the time of, say, The King of Comedy in 1983, let alone his whole, like, 21st century incarnation as, like, you know, comedic dad or something. It's sort of ribald, raunchy, and yet, like, completely unselfconscious kind of humor that I think he's really good at, actually. But, you know, you just don't see that sort of thing. And also something like Mean Street. Which, in a way, is a very, like, effectless performance.
Mm-hmm.
Something like Taxi Driver, I feel like, is very...
directed?
Directed, but it's also very methody, and it has this, like, self-importance about it. That is perhaps earned. It's, like, one of the great movie performances and one of the great movies of all time. Mm-hmm. Same thing in Raging Bull. I guess what I'm saying is, like, he's changed many times. I don't think that's fair to just say that you know, there's like one artist, the pre-82, like in the golden age of the, you know, the new Hollywood guy. And then after that, he's just been mailing them in.
I literally grew up with those films. And so, but nobody has wanted him to succeed or to engage himself, you know, and deliver performances more than me. I mean, you know, as much as anybody else, having gone through such an intense period, you know, years ago of like just, you know, exalting him. And so it's just,
it's not the same. I know it's not the
but
same.
But that's not just his fault. I'm
but
not,
you know what?
You know, we're
listening to the new Neil Young albums isn't the same. You know, I mean, we just got to deal with it. Yeah. Guys get older, maybe they can't hack it like they could.
No.
I like the new Neil Young album.
Right, just as a disclaimer. Just we're disclaimer. Not saying.
I think Psychedelic Pill, the new Neil Young album, which sounds like it was recorded in 1966, which never ended for Neil Young.
Right. Oh, yeah, because he's lo-fi all the way.
Yeah, but, I mean, it's great. You know, it's like what you want out of...
Yeah, we're going to hear it on one of the tracks as the show ends, by the way.
Oh, really?
You got it. But, you know, like De Niro, when you think about or talk about or... put Neil Young in some sort of context, it is the context of a career to look at somebody's every performance as an individual thing and then that represents them. That's not fair. And then maybe that's what you're kind of suggesting is that a part of what Neil Young's whole approach is there has to be failure because he's taking risks. And when you're going to fail sometimes.
And then there were like the bad Eddie Vedder collaborations. You guys remember that when he like got really an Eddie Vedder for a while, and
right?
They like did like
he went through the phase of like attaching himself to a number of grunge bands,
right? Yeah.
Oh, well, you're right.
Poor guy.
But you know, it's interesting when he's always attached himself to Green Day and these other bands. I mean, it obviously feels on some level like it's tactical,
right?
But on the other hand, it works. Like it's also okay. He's got the track record. He actually is relevant for like 5 decades now.
Well,
it's
you
not,
never feel like he's putting you on by doing it,
right?
I mean, I think that there's always a genuine attempt to make something.
There's
interesting,
not some marketing person whispering
not,
in his ear
if he's not making something interesting. Like the was it the Greendale album,
mm-hmm.
the album for the Jarmusch film as well.
Yeah,
and I think that stuff is great. But it is also, you know, it's like an earnest attempt to do something new. But I guess that's why I found the most recent album kind of interesting, is that it actually like on the beach or something. I mean, it's hearkening back to this bygone era of musical production and of his career, if you will. But not in a way that seems overly nostalgic. Like, he just seems to own it, you know. And that's great. Like, when someone can really just invest them with enough earnestness and care and craftsmanship that they're still kind of great.
There was a recent article on him where he's driving through where he lives, I guess, maybe he might be in Ontario somewhere. I thought he was like pointing out the places that he grew up in, but the thing is, he's following his brother Bob Young, and who's in a car ahead of them.
Wait, isn't
what was that?
Didn't Jonathan Demme photograph this while this was happening? Because I've seen a movie.
Very possibly Jonathan Demme
on a plane
to
a bad film festival.
Oh, okay. Where it was one of Demme's films.
Yeah, Demme has done 3 movies about.
I know. Yeah.
And one of them, he's like driving around with Neil Young, and Neil Young is following his brother.
Yes.
And they're like somewhere.
That's what it is. Then. It wasn't an article
or something.
Okay.
And it was, and then it intercuts that with like, it's called Neil Young Journeys, I think.
Okay.
And
you're
it
right.
intercuts that with like, you know, him performing.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, so it wasn't an article. Okay. I just kind of vaguely remember the experience. But it's interesting because I did have a visual in my mind of it. Sometimes you're reading an article, like a Brandon Harris article, that's so, it's so visual that you can't be sure whether you saw it or read it. But you're right. The first one was the one at the Ryman Auditorium, and it was just a Neil Young concert, the first of the trilogy.
Right.
Do you remember the name of that one?
There was Heart of Gold.
Yeah. Then Trunk Show was the third one. I haven't seen that.
Okay, so Journeys was the second one.
Right, yeah.
Well, I saw it on a plane to some foreign country. And
you make a lot of trips.
I do.
You have an article in the Brooklyn Rail called The Emancipation Wet Dream, which is an article that you wrote on Django Unchained, the new Quentin Tarantino movie. But in the broader context, it's about how a number of recent films, including a couple that even aren't quite out yet, but they're in the festival circuit, like Gimme Loot.
Mm-hmm. They're both coming out next month, actually.
What was the other one?
Welcome to Pine Hill.
Welcome to Pine Hill, right. And then, of course, the recent enormous Oscar-nominated success of...
White House Feted.
Oprah endorsed.
Yeah, no, Ben and Dwight and Quivizane. We're at the White House yesterday.
I'm a few days behind.
Yeah.
So that's quite the seal of approval. You speak about all the complex nuances to this article. and how complex the topic of race is, especially the point being that a number of white filmmakers have made films like Beast of the Southern Wild. Again, you know, in a way, it goes back to, if I may make another comparison to what we were just talking about with artists like Robert De Niro and Neil Young. Each one on its own has its merits and its flaws. But what you're looking at, obviously, is a trend.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know, I can't remark on whether you find it disturbing, but the article has gotten a lot of, you've gotten a lot of feedback about it.
Well, it, you know, I have. I mean, mostly positive. I'm sure there are plenty of naysayers out there. I hear from some of my friends in the independent film community, they've had interesting conversations about the article this week, but then that's all they'll say, at least in, you know, on the internet.
Yeah, right,
I'm sure they'd say other things in person. I mean, what the piece talks about specifically is the historical revisionism that's at the basis of Django Unchained, and how dangerous I find that, given that it's one of the rare depictions of the South prior to the Civil War that will receive nearly that much attention or cultural prestige.
Mm-hmm.
But then, in general, just that, like, why would someone want to indulge in that sort of cathartic fantasy making, as Tarantino does? And then I talk about his oeuvre and his relationship to African-American identity throughout his films, and his sort of special place as this white filmmaker who feels compelled to use the word nigger very freely, or to make a film such as Jackie Brown, that I think is a really wonderful film about a working-class African-American woman that you, I mean, you just rarely see. I mean, it's actually a very unique and wonderful film. But then I expand upon that to talk about how, you know, in many ways, it's kind of like the best and worst of times for black cinema, however you choose to define that term, whether that means like movies about African-American experiences or movies by African-American artists. These are often two very separate things. I mean, you know, obviously you've had two consecutive Best Director winners at Sundance be African-Americans, yet the movies that seem to have the most cultural prestige, pop cultural currency, mainstream viability, and festival circuit success happen to be films by more or less privileged white filmmakers about either poverty-stricken or severely suppressed African-Americans. And that generally these films work in one of several modes. Some are like exercises in guttural realist miserabilism, if you will.
Mm-hmm.
Others are magical realist flights of fantasy. And others are seemingly cathartic revenge spectacles. But all of them suppress any real notion of radicalism or the defining qualities of the black working class people that I know. I just find them to be a bit spacious. But beyond that critical assessment of how they mediate reality, my question is, like, why are they all the rage now, like, together?
Mm.
And is there something to learn from that? And so that's kind of what the essay is about. It also talks about Lincoln quite a bit.
Especially the opening scene in Lincoln.
Sure.
I think is a great example of what you're talking about as well, by not an indie filmmaker.
Funny thing about Lincoln is like such an interesting movie, because it really does.
I still love that ending.
The movie ends like five times.
Oh, well, I guess the one where Tommy Lee Jones is climbing into bed.
Well, that could have been the end, yeah, but then it ends like three other times after that. That's a great little surprise.
Yes.
You know, the point I want to make about Lincoln, and the point I make in the piece, is that it relegates to the sidelines the Tommy Lee Jones character's point of view, which is actually a fairly mainstream abolitionist, you know, mainline abolitionist belief that Reconstruction would have to be swift and fairly vicious.
That's very true.
For any sort of equality to take hold in the South. And as history showed
well,
us,
it was not.
It didn't. So Lincoln was wrong, you know?
I know.
That's just my bone to pick for that particular film, is that the movie suggests that it's like a historical certainty that Lincoln's beliefs are like the perfect middle ground that was the only possible outcome from the aftermath of the war. Which is just quite frankly not true. And then, you know, the other failing I found is that the movie kind of doesn't deal with Lincoln's own struggles with racism. You know, this is something who widely used racial epithets, who many, many times in the early part of his administration shirked off the possibility of ending slavery, who in fact revoked the Emancipation Proclamation by James Clement, the very first Republican Party candidate for president in 1856, who was later the general in charge of all the Union's armies west of the Mississippi River. I mean, this is some real Civil War nerd shit.
at some point or other, there was this idea of contextual bigotry. And to me, people shouldn't be left off the hook. Like, you make choices. And
yeah.
By the way, my litmus is always, but what about those guys like the abolitionists that were there too? And they just said, no, this is terrible. This is wrong. And they made that choice. And you know, I've had many internal conversations where I was like, what if I was around and I had money? And, you know, where would I have been? What would I have done? And I don't have any idea. I really don't know what I would have done. I might have come up with a whole rationale for anything I would have done, you know? But I
might have been one of the characters in James P. Jones's The Known World, who were black slave owners in Virginia. I mean, those people existed. High yellow black slave owners. Mm-hmm. They were around, you know? So, yeah. I mean, who knows?
Right.
These are very complicated moral
issues.
Very complicated moral issues. But getting back to Django a little bit, I mean, Django renders the Civil War perfectly unnecessary. I mean, if there were black people like that, shit, who needs the Civil War? I don't need any Civil War. Just get some German dentists and free ourselves.
Coincidentally named King.
And Kerry Washington is quite gorgeous, though. You want to save her from the whippings.
Yeah, well, you know, he is the best.
The other, like, 12 lumbering black guys who are standing around, like, whatever. The perfect example of that is at the beginning of the movie, James Remar and the other guy who's playing the brothers, you know, they get offed by King Schultz, and then he's gonna, you know, take his own guy. But, like, what about those other 7 guys who are still in chains in the cold, man?
Yeah.
You know, I mean, it like they get their comeuppance ostensibly by they're like, oh, you know, King Charles is like, oh, we'll do whatever with this guy you want. Mm-hmm. So you assume from the minute one, it's like, well, clearly the movie almost argues ostensibly that the only thing that could free African Americans is the desire for revenge, or that is the primary gift of freedom. You know, I don't know if Quentin Tarantino would agree with
that. I wish he were here to.
I'd be happy to debate it with him. You know, I sent that article to his good friend, Elvis Mitchell, who, you know, I know, like, cavorts with him in Iceland or something every once in a while. I'm sure those are good parties. But nonetheless, like, you know, I sent to Elvis, and I name-drop Elvis in the piece. I was like, you're really curious to hear, A, what you think about
this. Because, you know, he Googles himself.
Oh, I'm sure he's on Google Alert all the time.
Yeah.
Yeah. But, you know, I'm curious to see what, not just what you think about this, but what perhaps Tarantino thinks about this. Mm-hmm. And he did write me back and said he had not found the time to write the piece yet, but that he would.
That's probably true.
And I doubt that he will.
I don't know. This is Adam Shartoff, host of FilmWax Radio, the independent film talk show, Wednesday night, 6:30 to 7:30 on bboxradio.com.
Did you like blaxploitation movies? Growing up, Adam?
Did you watch those at all? You know, when I was a kid, here's what I remember.
Were they like, available?
Sort of, yes, like, sort of. Well, a movie like Blackula, for instance, I remember. I remember Shaft when I was older, but I don't remember when it came out. Like,
sure.
Because Shaft crossed over into mainstream, you know, culture, as did...
Well, a sweep back to a degree, but I think that Shaft and Superfly
were the true...
Yeah.
Right. But a movie like Caesar, Black Caesar. Did not, in my mind, or
that's
a film like Sweet
one.
Ass... Sweet Badass.
Sweet Badass with 5 S's sunk.
Yes, the Van Peebles films. But interestingly enough, because I was a kid, what I wanted to see, and I don't think I ever did, was Blackula. That just had an intrigue to me, because it was... It's sort of an updated Dracula.
Genre, yeah.
Also, when I was a kid, I loved Get Christy Love, which was sort of a TV cop show.
Yeah.
Based loosely on...
So Tamara Dobson?
I don't know. She was just unbelievably gorgeous. Anyway, but that was more what I was exposed to. But that kind of was based loosely on those Pam Grier characters.
Coffee and Foxy Brown. They're actually doing Pam Grier...
grabbing the gun out of the afro.
Right, yeah, the gun out of the afro. I believe that is in Coffee.
Okay.
There's also the Big Birdcage. Let's not forget, she got her start doing these exploitation movies for Roger Corman. They weren't necessarily blaxploitation movies. She was just the hot black chick. In the women's prison.
Was the genre. Women's prison films.
Full circle, coming back to Jonathan Demme.
Who worked for
Roger Corman.
Roger Corman.
And got to start writing scripts for Roger Corman. And one time Jonathan Demme was at Purchase College when I was going to film school there. And we were doing this very respectful, quaint, you know, like kind of masterclass thing where he was talking about his work. Someone asked him, you know, what the film he thought was the least appreciated of all his films were. And one film immediately came to mind for me, which I'll get to in a second. What he said was, well, I think it was clearly Beloved. And then he spoke in these very reverent tones about Toni Morrison's work and about the importance of that text and of that movie, and that maybe that America wasn't ready for that film. And I actually saw Beloved in a print again about 3 or 4 months ago. It's a pretty good movie. Can't do what that novel does. It is cool to see a period movie set in Cincinnati, Ohio. That's kind of fun. But then, you know, so I raised my hand and was like, so was it you or was it your writing partner or was it Roger Corman who came up with the title of the Pam Grier, Margaret Markov vehicle, Black Mama, White Mama? Because I think that that's your most underappreciated work. I love that movie. And I love the Defiant Ones with Sidney Poitier is a good movie, but that doesn't hold a candle to Black Mama, White Mama. Black Mama, White Mama is set in this unnamed South American country. And it's about two women who are chained together and they escape from a bus trip to like a work camp or something from the prison. And so then they're in the South American hills strangling dudes and taking their guns and then fighting amongst themselves. He claims that he didn't come up with the title.
That would make sense. That was his writing partner. Sure.
Because
let's face it, he gave the socially correct response by saying Beloved.
But I mean, let's think about Beloved, though. Beloved might have been certainly the most expensive movie about American slavery or the aftermath or effects of American slavery until Django Unchained, potentially.
I don't know.
Beloved was an $80 million movie, and it made nothing. I mean, I think they did like $22-23 million domestic, and it died. It died a really terrible death. Disney lost a shitload of money on that film. And that, I mean, never again would we see that kind of depiction of slavery released on 2 or 3,000 screens. But
it was Amistad was right before that.
That was 97.
Yeah.
But not until Lincoln and Django have there been other depictions of this sort of thing.
Brandon Harris is here, journalist, filmmaker, now film series
curator.
You recently have taken up the task of getting into curating a film series now with a partnership of Hammer to Nail. For those who don't know, Hammer to Nail is a blog, primarily an interview and review blog around independent film, started by, I think, Ted Hope. Or he's one of the starters of it. And
Ted Hope and Michael Tully and Corbin Day is involved, and Mike Ryan was there toward the beginning. But yeah, Michael Tully is the editor, and you know, I think the whole thing was Ted's idea initially, and it's been going for 5 years now.
And you've contributed? I've contributed.
I've contributed quite a bit, yeah. And more so, you know, it's funny. I think the screening series was born out of a desire to contribute more and trying to find a way that I could do that outside of writing, just because, like, most of my writing energies are going toward other things now. And so, you know, I maybe in the last couple of years I've only contributed half dozen times a year, if that.
Right.
And so, I've been trying to figure out a way to be a little bit more involved. We did have a screening series years ago.
Okay.
At a video store in Chinatown that is now gone called Cinema Nolita. And Eleanor Hendricks, the actress.
Who's on my show this week.
Director. And, so she and I had this series that was the initial Hammer and Nail screening series. And then... And we had some really good screenings. We did Miss 45 one week, where Abel Ferrara showed up and did an hour and change Q&A at like midnight. Because the screening started at like 11.
Yeah. Oh, wow.
On a
Sunday. This is great.
So Abel came up, showed up at like 12:30, and we all stayed there until
like the hardcore.
Before 2. And he drank an entire six-pack in the hour and change and talked about what he's doing. This is before he got sober. Abel's sober now. He doesn't do things like this. Anyway. So, you know, we did that, and it was great, and the video store closed. And it was super sad, but, you know, in this economy, video stores are a dying breed anyway. It went by the wayside, and so did the screening series. So cut to 3.5, almost 4 years later, after the demise of that store, and I was approached by the people at Brooklyn Fireproof, this great bar and gallery and soundstage and office space in Bushwick. if I would be interested in curating series of films. And I was, but I thought that it would be a good way to bring back this mm-hmm. Hammer and Nail screening series that we've been doing previously and support some of the films and filmmakers we're already writing about on the site and covering on the site. This thing is going to be a bi-weekly series. And the next one is going to be a week from this Sunday. And it is a screening of David Nordstrom's Sawdust City.
I don't know that one.
A very little seen indie, which I believe will be making its New York premiere.
Brandon Harris, let's mention again these articles that you want to do. Just Google Brandon, or even better, maybe set up an RSS feed, because when you do an article, there's a payoff in it. And you don't have a lot of peers right now. No disrespect if I'm missing anybody, but it just seems like when you want to get something with actually some heft to it.
Wait, too. David Nordstrom's calling me, right? Can I pick this up while we're on the air?
Yeah.
David, I'm on the radio announcing that your movie is playing the Hammer and Nail screen series.
Hi, David.
Hello.
David's calling in.
Hey.
Hey, man. This is Adam.
Hello.
It's Adam.
Hello, New York.
Yeah, we're on B-Box Radio right now talking about the Hammer and Nail screening series. This is David Nordstrom, guys, the director of Sawdust City.
Wow. David, welcome. This is Adam. I'm the host.
Sure. Adam, hi.
You've been ambushed.
Are we on New York radio, or is it like streaming?
This is like podcasting.
It is a streamed show on the interwebs, but it's also a podcast. David, describe the film though. Sawdust City.
Yeah, this is a movie that I made with a few close friends after writing a number of screenplays that were just going to require a lot of budget mm-hmm. and kind of logistics and like a longer time frame, and it kind of grew out of this frustration, just wanting to make a movie, to make a feature, and rewrote it in like, probably about 3-4 months, and workshopped it extensively in L.A. Then I flew out. Mm-hmm. Close friends who I had written the parts for, we filmed it there over just like a period of 2 weeks. We had a couple days of interiors out in L.A., mm-hmm. and that was it.
So I saw David's movie initially in Poland
mm-hmm.
at Off Camera, a fantastic festival out there in Krakow. But the movie world premiered at the Los Angeles Film Festival in 2011.
Mm-hmm.
And will this be the New York premiere? Have you screened in New York before, David?
No, we didn't screen in New York. This is it.
Wow. So Hammer and Nail screening series, our very first New York premiere in that case.
Wonderful.
Next Sunday night.
It's an honor. I wish I could be there.
What time is it, Brandon? Give the
doors open at 7 o'clock. Screening starts at 7:30. Tickets are $6, although with $10 you get not only a ticket but any drink you want at the Brooklyn Fireproof East Bar.
Wow, that's pretty cool.
And they have a pretty nice selection of bourbons, as I discovered last Sunday.
So that's on Sunday?
That is Sunday the 24th.
The 24th. Very good.
And the film will be screening with one of the winners from our Hammer and Nail short film contest.
Perfect. A beautiful convergence of quality independent cinema. David, thank you. You did really well. And I look forward to seeing the film.
All right. Thanks a lot.
You bet. Brandon, so let's just to quickly rehash before we say so long, or for the moment.
Very brief cameo by David Nordstrom, the
That's
director
fantastic.
Of Sawdust City.
Who, again,
is screening on February 24th at 7:30.
Well, but doors open at 7, and we want you to come in and hang out with us and have a drink first.
Absolutely.
What great independent film isn't further enhanced by slight lubrication?
Especially this movie, which is about young men kind of struggling in their small Midwestern hamlet to come to grips with adulthood and come to grips with what their father means to them.
Mm-hmm.
I think it's a movie that probably is well served by alcohol or a familiarity with Garrison Keillor.
Garrison Keillor. So that's, again, Sunday night at Brooklyn Fireproof in Bushwick. Look it up. We'll have what we'll do is we'll have on our shows, the show's webpage, we'll have all the details and the links and all that kind of stuff. Sure. I urge you to read Brandon's articles. One is at thebrooklynrail.org.
The piece about Richard Pryor, called Pryor Restraint, is on the wonderful new literary and cultural website, The New Inquiry.
Oh, The New Inquiry. Okay, so take a look at those. And his continued contribution to Filmmaker Magazine, et cetera, et cetera. Mm-hmm. And thank you again for coming by. We'll see you.
Good to be here, as always.
Thank you. Man, who could